story the way I want to, but I don't want to sit on
the Senate Environment Committee will come to order. I appreciate your patience while I was finishing my cookie. Got a full agenda today. We're going to take up a variety of game and fish issues. Senator Erickson Ropes is waiting for another committee, so we'll take her first. Senate File 262, Senator Erickson Ropes, welcome to the committee. This is your first bill presentation.
Yes, sir.
So welcome. We're honored.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I'm happy to be here today. I am carrying this bill as a companion bill to a House version, and this originates from a constituent back home who saw some inconsistencies in the licensing provisions. So if it's okay with you, I'll just walk right through this. It's a very short change. Actually, if you look at subdivision 3, we're looking at fees that are attached to the licenses of non-residents. And you'll see that number 1, 2, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 all have standard numbers attached to the non-resident fees. And 3I is the only one here that includes a provision to link the fee for the license back to the non-resident's home state. So it came to our attention because we had a resident back home who had relatives come in from another state. And, of course, the resident license for a deer, for bow hunting licenses, this is only for deer and bow hunting licenses that we're talking about, is about $27. The non-residents were from Nevada, and they were going to be hunting deer by bow, and so therefore this provision linking them back to their original home state came into play, and they wound up having to pay $396 for their deer license. So they were looking at the non-hunting licensing structure, and then it was discovered that this is the only category where we charge non-resident hunters. We link their fee in Minnesota to their home state. So I am here asking you today if we can maintain some consistency in the licensing structure and delete I, as you see before you, just to include to take deer by archery, $135 as a set fee, just as items 1, 2, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 identify the targets and the fees.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Erickson-Ropes, did I hear you say that the fee for residents is $27?
Yes.
It's substantially above that for a non-resident.
Yes.
So it isn't as if we're waiving that, but I wonder if, I don't know if there's anybody here from DNR, there's got to be a story here. Mm-hmm. As to why that is this a big retaliatory thing with some state of the union or whatever? We need some entertainment here. So,
first of all, Senator, do you have any witnesses that you want to?
Mr. Chair, no. I have just a letter from a resident back home that initiated this on the House side.
Okay. And are you finished with your presentation?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Mr. Meyer.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. Senator Olson, yes, there is a history to this change in statute. It was passed, I believe, 2 years ago in the Game and Fish Bill, being brought forward by Senator Senjum on a constituent request from his district, trying to balance out the needs that were there, they were hearing, in Iowa versus non-resident archers. I believe a non-resident archer license in Iowa is about a little bit over $400 right now. So trying to bring some kind of par level for the reciprocity issues, only dealing with archery. It's the only license that we have that is like this. It is very difficult for the department to do. You have to come in and initially when it was set up, you had to buy your license through the St. Paul Licensing Center just because we had the tables, the updated information. Actually, this is similar to language we have in our game and fish bill this year to go back to just charging $135 for non-residents. We feel that with hunter recruitment and retention issues as important as they are and deer harvesting issues as important as they are, the more barriers we can remove from having people hunt and participate in outdoor activities in the state of Minnesota, the better off we are. So we do support the bill, but there is some legislative history that goes along with the issue.
Now, what, for example, what does Iowa charge Minnesotans for
400.
The archery?
400, she said.
Did you say $400?
Mr. Chair, members, it's about, I think, $435 approximately. I can provide the committee with a table on that, what the other states are charging Minnesota residents. However, I don't have that in this packet of information.
What then is, what's the Iowa resident fee?
Senator Chaudhry, I have the Iowa resident fee as $151 to
$221.50. That's high. Okay. Mr. Chairman?
There's Senator a range.
Olson. Mr. Chairman, it would seem to me that this way we would attract Iowa hunters here, but I can't imagine why anybody would want to go archery hunting in Iowa anyway for a deer anyway when you've got Minnesota.
That's a good question.
Well, at $400, I agree.
Well, Mr. Chairman, but they charge their residents higher than we charge non-residents here. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that at least helps keep Minnesota residents here hunting. And this change would attract Iowa residents to our state as well. Right?
Meyer? Mr. Meyer.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, the number of people that we may regain some hunters that did not hunt in Minnesota archery non-resident the past 2 years because of the cost. When comparing licenses, you have to compare what they're getting for what level of monetary cost. That could be, for example, a multi-zone tag, or it could be like our all-season license is $78 for residents, where you can hunt deer in the archery, rifle, and muzzleloader season. So you need to compare apples to apples, and if the committee is interested, we can pull together some of that information to present to you.
To your knowledge, does outstate, out-of-state archery hunting from non-residents in Minnesota, does that have a significant economic impact, to your knowledge?
Mr. Chair, I did get the fiscal note as I entered the room today, and do you have a copy of that?
Yes.
Okay. All right. The way I understand the fiscal note reads that there would be a $72,000 loss to the Fish and Game Fund because of moving to the $135 non-resident fee.
Just under $1,300.
But, Mr. Chairman?
I'm just wondering about the grand scheme of things. Is this going to improve tourism? Is this going to... Was it big to begin with, the archery folks coming in from out of state? Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chair, members, in 2006, we sold approximately 1,286 licenses, non-resident hunting licenses for archery. So that's how we come up with the $72,000 there. The economic impact off of those licensees, you know, you figure hotels, gas, meals, things of that nature are one set. I think previous to this change, we probably had more non-resident archers participating in the sport in Minnesota, so the economic impact was probably greater before we made the change than it currently is. So this, in answer to your question, would probably increase some of that economic activity.
All right. How many Minnesotans buy deer hunting licenses a year, roundabout?
Mr. Chair, members, Ed Bogus with DNR Division of Fish and Wildlife. Individuals who purchase deer licenses is approximately 450,000. And I don't have the exact numbers with me, but about 12,000 10 to 12,000 of those are non-resident individuals.
Okay. All right. So in the grand scheme of things, this is a pretty small percentage. Senator Parasol.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to ask either counsel or Greg Knopf if they can recall the story that Senator Senjum brought when this was changed last time, which was not so long ago. If you could recall the charger on the driver on that.
What was the idea behind this change, Mr. Knopf?
Mr. Chair, Senator Parasol, my recollection is a little different from Mr. Myers. I thought I remembered Senator Kierlin bringing this forward, but I could be wrong on it. It was a few years ago. The story was that there was somebody, and I think it was mentioned earlier, that there was a person who was concerned about the increased fees in Iowa for archery hunting and wanted to have something in place in Minnesota that would be of comparable nature for people coming from Iowa or from other states to hunt. And this was the result. It was, I don't know that Senator Kierlin ever presented it. That's why I thought it was Senator Kierlin, but I could be wrong on that. It was presented, I think, by somebody else in committee for the senator. And it was presented to the Game and Fish Subcommittee, if I remember correctly, and that they wanted to have something in place to counteract that fee. To so the state would have a comparable fee. They didn't want it applied to anything else but the archery because the person bringing it forward was an archery hunter, and that was the concern. I think once somebody did ask if they wanted it to expand it beyond that to also deal with the firearms, but they didn't want to get into that. So it was adopted in this form in subcommittee, and it passed all the way through the Senate, and then the House accepted it 2 years ago.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Knopf. But now when you bring up, I know Senator Kierlin had a bill drafted once, but then if it didn't succeed, possibly Senator Senjum brought it back on behalf of, you know, and I don't know about that part. But now I do recall that Senator Kierlin was the person who had a bill 1 year.
Senator Olson, did you have a follow-up?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bogus, you indicated there were 12,000 out-of-state resident deer hunting licenses, but is that all overall, not just archery? Didn't I hear 1,200 were archery?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, yes, that's correct. 12,000 would include firearms. We have somewhere around 70,000 archery hunters total, of which about 1,200 are non-residents.
So, Mr. Chairman, it would seem that, you know, fiscal notes don't always take into consideration the impact or change the behavior changes of people as a result of a policy. It's more the direct impact if you were just to reduce the same number down to a smaller amount. But you indicated, Mr. Meyer, that there were probably more out-of-state hunters before that was put in place, and now we have less. And if there is a desire to increase that may reduce or eliminate the negative impact of fiscally to the Game and Fish Fund. And did I hear you say also that actually the department is supporting this type of this measure? Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bickerman.
Just put this in perspective. My grandson owns 1/6 of a cabin we have up at up north Minnesota. And we always got together. And he's an expert archery. He doesn't like shotgun and rifle. He can't come because the cost is twice what he can afford to. There's a lot of deer in Iowa if you really want to get big deer.
He lives in Iowa.
I think this is more of a fairness issue than is anything. So why shouldn't my grandson be able to come up with his old grandpa and hunt in the same cabin? I'm going to tell you something. You can throw this thing out. I wouldn't want to even tell you what they spend on everything up there when they come here to hunt. I mean, they spend a lot more than that. So the money does come in. It just comes in a different way. And Sharon Ropes, I think you got a wonderful bill here.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, sir.
Well, I mean, if the fee is reduced, there could be more hunters coming in, and this number could actually go up as opposed to down. This is only just given the information we have. I don't think there's any giant sucking sound of archery, archery hunter, deer hunters coming either way. So if it makes the system simpler, we might get a few more here, makes it a little more fairer. If we don't need to retaliate against Iowa anymore, then I think that's enough for the policy committee to pass it through and let the finance committee decide if they want to spend the money. Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question, and I also have an amendment to another part of this bill. But, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Boggess, we've been talking about fair and equitable treatment of archery participants in other states and also about economic development. But I think probably our main focus should be, is a deer herd large enough? How is the resource of the deer herd? Does this have any effect on the deer herd, and what is the desired harvest of deer compared to what the actual harvest is?
Mr. Chair, Senator Frederickson, as I'm sure you're aware, we have no shortage of deer, and we're looking at methods to encourage more taking of deer. So this will not have any effect on that.
Chairman, Mr. Boggess, Mr. Chairman, I suspect that that was the case, and I think that's another argument for passing the bill. But my amendment would be on line 117, line 17 of page 1. Delete the first comma, insert or, and delete everything after the second comma.
Okay, so Senator Frederickson is moving to amend Senate File 262. Line 17, it would basically read to take raccoon or bobcat.
Mr. Chairman, that's right.
And would delete fox or coyote from the non-resident license. So you wouldn't have to buy a license if you're out of state to hunt fox or coyote in Minnesota under your amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I believe the situation would be you would need a non-resident small game license to take fox. Coyotes are not protected, so anybody could shoot coyotes. Fox and coyotes are predators on our game birds, on our songbirds. We have an overabundance of them. I see no reason why we shouldn't let non-residents help us keep those predators under control.
So they would fall under small game.
Discussion on the amendment.
And Senator Erickson Ropes, I apologize for not telling you about this amendment earlier. I just saw this now when I saw the bill here.
Thank you.
Department. Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, members, we did discuss this issue with Senator Frederickson before the committee, and we can support the amendment.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm always interested when we do these sorts of things, what the biologists have to say about it. Does Senator Frederickson have any insights? I know when Senator Kubley had the coyote bounty, biologists were a little skeptical about the outcomes that he was seeking in that effort.
Senator Frederickson was opposed to that, mm-hmm. as I recall. We have an open season on coyotes at the moment, so there seems to be no concern about the restricting of the taking of coyotes because they are in such overabundance. But I'll let Senator Frederickson explain.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, I'm aware that we have a burgeoning population of coyotes, mm-hmm. and that they are very—they are predators, and they prey on our duck population, our pheasant population, also small deer, songbirds, other game animals, and I know there's an effort to try and control them.
Mm-hmm.
And I would, frankly, just as soon see non-residents help us control that population. Mm-hmm. And the other effect of the amendment on fox, you would still need a small game license, I believe. And, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Knopf has identified another change we would need to make.
Mr. Knopf.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Frederickson, I was just pointing out that this is linked to a provision in Chapter 97B. It's 97B-601, Subdivision 3, where it says a non-resident may not take raccoon, bobcat, fox, or coyote by firearms without a separate license to take that animal in addition to the small game license. So you would need to also amend it in that provision that's not in the bill in front of us. It would have to be a comparable amendment to that Subdivision 3.
Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Knopf, could we make that amendment now?
Well,
it would be difficult to do. Could it be a deletion?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Fredrickson, the language is not in front of you. The only we could either make a copy of the language and then and pass that out, or you can just leave it up to me to come up with the amendment, the comparable amendment to that section that would match with this.
Mr. Chairman, would the committee be comfortable in allowing Mr. Knopf to make a conforming amendment to the section you referenced?
And it's pretty simple.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, you would just adopt it as part of the committee report, then I'll make sure that the secretary gets a copy of that to include with it.
Senator Parasol.
Mr. Chairman, before we get to that point, I recognize four animals there on that line 117 that are also taken by trappers, where the pelts are actually going into the market then. Shooting them would, of course, ruin the pelt. And so I'm wondering how department might tell us how many go out as hunted versus those that are trapped today, if they have any sense of how that splits out today before this changes.
Mr. Meyer or Mr. Bogus?
Mr. Chair and Senator Parasol, we do have those numbers, and it used to be, I haven't looked at them for a few years, it used to be that the majority were taken by trapping, but a significant amount of raccoon and fox are also taken by hunting, but it was like 70% by trapping for fox and maybe more like 60% for raccoon. I'm not sure in recent years. I suspect it's probably higher to trapping. And a number of hunters do sell the pelt. There is sometimes damage, but many of them are sold. And we do now have a season on fox and raccoon, so that the time of the year that the pelt is not valued, the season is closed. So we have directed more of that take by hunting or trapping to the time that the pelt has value, and some hunters just chase them and don't kill them, but most that kill them will sell them.
Mr. Chairman, I just have to say, of course, I know Senator Olson's aware of this because she has plenty of nuisance raccoon around her area, and they're really a nuisance animal most of the time, so people just want to do everything they can to get rid of them.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, I'm just wondering why the elevated fee for taking raccoon. The only natural predator to them seems to be the automobile. And they certainly do get overpopulated in some areas. Is there a rationale for not putting them under small game as well? Or
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, it's a little bit like the other issue in this bill. There's a history here. I just researched it a few weeks ago because we had an email to respond to from a former Minnesota resident who's now a resident of Wisconsin that was very upset with this provision in law, and so I had to go back and kind of remember what happened. But starting in the late 1970s and then through various versions in the early 1980s, this law came to be in its present form. It started out as a non-resident raccoon license, and it was sort of a retaliation against people from southern states, Iowa and farther south, Arkansas, people with Tennessee jumping mules and things like that coming up to the state and taking the raccoons. This was at a time when fur prices were very high. There was a lot of concern about competition from non-residents, and some of the hound organizations, Trail Hound Association, really pressed for this legislation. So initially it was for raccoons only. It included a season limit on raccoons. Non-residents could only take 6 raccoons a year. It later was expanded to include these other species that you see here, and lynx. At the time, lynx were legal to take, and we've since removed lynx from this. But so it was something that some of our resident hunters pushed for.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Would there be any opposition just to letting the bobcat stand by himself with the 155 and moving the raccoon to small game? I don't know if that is a consideration that Senator Fredrickson is making or not.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I'm targeting coyotes and fox.
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. I need to go to another meeting to present another bill, so I'm wondering if I would lay the question on the table regarding the non-resident deer and archery license fee. If you have any other questions on that issue, I'd be happy to take that. Otherwise, I, as you take up Bobcat and Fox and reminisce about where these actions came from,
We're wrapping up this discussion.
Thank you, sir.
Just quick question. What do you have numbers on the non-resident fox and coyote licenses?
Mr. Chair, we didn't come prepared for this discussion, so we can get you those numbers. They're relatively low, though, I know that, because it's a very expensive license.
On the Fredrickson Amendment.
Mr. Chair, just
Senator Rickerman.
If you think that I'm going to open all my farmland up to everybody to come in running, hunting dogs after raccoons, just remember that that's my property, and I shouldn't have to post it. We got to be careful. We don't have a whole ton of people coming in here from another state and just going after.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Fredrickson.
On my property, without my permission.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Vickerman, we're not changing the raccoon at all. This only affects. Well, my amendment only affects fox and coyote.
And we're not changing any access rules either in this. No. It's just the non-resident fees, which is a relatively small amount anyway. On the Fredrickson Amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted.
Chairman, I would move that Senate File 262 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
Further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Chair and Committee.
Okay, we'll take Senate File 88 next. Senator Parasol, are we going to present?
88. Mr. Chairman and members, I'm standing in for Senator Fischbach, who is not here today. And her bill, Senate File 888, we have some witnesses here. I know you have them listed. I'll ask them to come to the table, please. Mr. Chairman and members, this makes a change to the excuse me, the baiting statutes for baiting for bears. And the witnesses here, I think, can introduce themselves. And I know the gentleman to my right is the designer of the Bear Baiter Buffet that you have a brochure in front of you. So,
Senators, thank you for having us here today.
Your time.
I'm Mike Lucan, and I invented the Bear Baiter Buffet. My wife, Kirsten. And we just wanted to go over the bear law because right now it says that we couldn't use something like that or it's very vague because I had talked to, I think, about 6 or 7 conservation officers and I get 3 of them said I could use it and 3 said we couldn't use it in the state, so it's a very vague law. That's why we came here to try and get it a little more user-friendly so everybody can understand it.
Tell us what your device does and why the law is confusing about it.
Our device is designed to have 6 containers each day. You can put in different bait in each container, so it can open up one day at a time. You only have to bait once a week. You have different bait in each container. When the timer sets, when you set the clock to have the timer open, and it will open and spray a scent in the air to help attract the bear to the baiter, to your bait station. And also the timer control shuts at night. You can set it so you can shut it at a certain time, let's say at 8 o'clock when shooting hours are over, about 8:15. So the door will shut and you get no night scavengers in, and the bears will not come in at night because there is nothing to get, no food for them to get. Makes it a little easier for the hunter to get a bear during legal shooting hours because they won't feed at night and keep the raccoons off. I know you guys are just talking about it, but you can have a bear bait station cleaned up, probably 100, 150 pounds of bait. 10, 12 raccoons will come in at night and clean up your whole bait, and you basically don't have a bear bait. You have a raccoon bait because there's no food there because the other animals come in and scavenge in at night.
And what's the problem with the law in allowing that?
The way the law is currently written right now, what it states is
Could you please introduce yourself?
Yeah.
My name is Kirsten Lucan. What it states is what the bait itself cannot contain. So 97B.425 is currently the baiting bears statute that we're looking at. And it says to attract a bear, a person cannot use six specific items. Part of the DNR booklet that is sent out to everyone that applies for a bear hunting license includes a provision in there that states specifically that you cannot use at your bait stations things such as 5-gallon drums, buckets, pails, any kind of metal container. And we did research on this prior to producing this product, trying to determine where that particular prohibition came from. We were always referred back to this statute, the bait statute. And it's my understanding that part of the DNR, their interpretation of what constitutes a bait is not just simply the food that you're using to attract the bear, but the actual container that you are placing that bait then in. That's how they are interpreting this particular statute to prohibit the use of such items as already described. What we're seeking to do is allow a very limited use here so that hunters can use our Bear Baiter Buffet here in the state of Minnesota, since it is a metal container that, per the DNR definition of bait, would suddenly become part of the bait as the law is currently written.
The line that says to attract a bear, a person may not use a bait with materials that are not readily biodegradable.
Is that the line?
Is that kind of the catch-all that says you basically have to dump your bait kind of outside, and it has to be outside sitting there as opposed to inside
container. Correct. But what we're saying is that the way the law is currently written, it's very vague because, quite frankly, a bucket that you use to carry your bait out to your bait site isn't the bait. It's a bucket. It's a carrier. It's a container. So you're not necessarily leaving that for the bear to eat. You don't want the bear to eat that. But that would certainly be a non-biodegradable material. And we understand the DNR's concern. I mean, we certainly don't want the woods to be littered with containers, you know, plastic buckets, ice cream pails, these metal containers either, because we're hunters too. So we want to go out and enjoy the woods as well. But you're right now with this product, what it opens up the door for is it allows many more hunters the opportunity to actually hunt bear. Right now you have so many people that are limited at the time from driving down here to the cities, maybe 4 hours north or 2 hours. They dump their bait, and then they have to come back here and go to work. And so they don't have that opportunity, that luxury of going every single day to their bait site to rebait it. This product allows them that luxury of not having to do that. But in order to do that, of course, we don't want it to conflict with the law as it's currently being interpreted or as it currently stands.
Do you take a bucket out there? Do you leave the bucket? Or do you just dump the
contents? You don't right now, because according to the DNR regulation booklet that is sent out, you can't. You can't do that.
That's littering.
But what we're saying is right now, with the way that this law is written, it specifically is applicable to the bait, not to a container. The way the language is right here, it says that you may not use a bait with these items in it. So it pertains specifically to the bait, but not necessarily a container. The way this law is written right now, if I take my vehicle out to the woods and I have bait in my vehicle, and this is an extreme case, but I have bait in my vehicle and I take it out to the woods, what happens is my vehicle now has become bait by the DNR interpretation of the statute, which is a ridiculous concept and certainly not what the DNR is intending. But just doing a blanket application of this law, that's what it would imply. That's why we're seeking to have some clarification within this so that we're not necessarily saying, you go ahead and use your 5-gallon ice cream pail or your little plastic bucket and take it out there and leave it. But certainly that there is a container that can be used that you can use to help with baiting a bear.
Senator Parasol. Mr. Chairman, I would mention that one of the comments in the list of six there is the materials that are not readily biodegradable. Well, a whole lot of the people who use bait for bear are buying foodstuffs, and typically they are the sweets. You know, they go to the bakery discount stores that are throwing things away, and they take whole loads of it home. But they have to open every one of those small packages of Twinkies, cupcakes, and all that stuff because they can't leave the packaging out there. That's the non-biodegradable. I mean, that's what I think the non-biodegradable section is there on number five, materials that are not readily biodegradable. So you have to just put it out there in a position in the way that the bear will eat it, and it's the content, not the packaging. So you'd be littering if you left the bucket out there or the packages or anything else. So I think this is a reasonable thing for us to consider as a permanent container for the bait, which is what's in the inside of it, not the container itself.
Mr. Chair, as a definition of the DNR bait...
Mr. Luckin.
Bait is defined here. Bait is any material placed for the purpose of attracting or attempting to attract a bear to the bear station. Well, if you take our metal container out and put it out in the woods and don't have any food in it, it will not attract a bear. So they're trying to link that with non-biodegradable material. So just putting an empty pail out in the woods itself is not considered bait because that will not attract a bear. They're kind of trying to tie two things together the way we see it.
Did you have your hand up, Senator Bickerman?
I'm just curious, Mr. Chairman, how many dollars are we due? I'm a bear hunter. Do I have to put out to get one of these?
How much does your beer baiter buffet cost?
Mr. Chair, it is $799.
And do guides mainly buy this?
Right now, we have most of them are sold to individuals.
How many can you have? Mr. Chair.
Senator Vickerman.
It's not a follow-up question. How many of these could you have, 10, 12, 1,500, or is there a certain limit of what you have to have? How many of these can you stack out if you have a guide? And I know people guide up in Park Rapids. Would they be able to just put these all over? Or? I'm just curious.
Mr. Luckin.
The Chair. Guides can probably, I don't know if there is a restriction on how many baits a guide can put out.
I do know that if you're a bear baiter, you get, after you put out a couple spots, you get tired of hauling 5-gallon pails and putting it out there because I've watched them do it. I was just curious if maybe you could put 10 of these out, it'd be a lot easier than carrying a 5-gallon bucket that you have.
If you get that much money,
put logs, we've done it.
Well, I think that's kind of the question here. It certainly would be a lot easier. And the question is, you know, are we staying true to the hunting aspect of this by starting to use more electronic devices? And you said that your device also sprays a scent?
Correct.
Senator Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm kind of wondering about the timer. It mentions that there's a timer on it. Is this, how does that work?
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson.
Senator Luckin, Mr. Luckin.
The timer it's in the top of the, if you look on a baiter, it's on the top. You set the time for time of day when it opens for instance, 7 o'clock in the morning or 6:15. I believe early season September you can start shooting about 6:30 is legal light. So we had the baiter set to open the door at 6:30. So the door would open up and a scent spray will send up in a tree to help attract the bear. Can have very good sense of smell and help attract the bear into the bait, and you'll be able to shoot them during that time.
So, Mr. Chair, so the idea is that you can time the exact arrival of the bear, and then you can show up and shoot them right at that time, because the bears are pretty smart at coming at the right time.
Mr. Chair, it's still hunting. There's no way to say that a bear will come in there 100%. It's just another aid, as in a scope on a rifle to help you shoot better. It's just another aid in hunting.
Mr. Chair, and I think this is a very clever invention, and I give you credit for it. But I have some trouble with the ethic of hunting that goes along with that. I don't know. Someone remind me what the whole discussion we had about bear baiting when we first passed the law. I mean, I don't remember the discussion from those who know more about hunting. You know, what was the idea behind it? That it's just put a pile of food in the woods to help attract bears? Mm-hmm. Do we do that in any other kind of hunting, other kind of game?
Mr. Knopf, do you want to address
Chairman,
that?
Senator Anderson, we don't with any other kind of game. I think they had the issue with baiting in Wisconsin for a deer. That caused them a lot of problems over there. But we don't with any other game that I'm aware of, at least not a game animal, one that's a protected species. But it's been in existence for quite a number of years. I know the game and fish laws were recodified in 1986, and it was around prior to that. So it's been quite a few years that baiting has been allowed. The other issue that is, of course, chasing bears with dogs has been an issue that mm-hmm. has been brought yes, forward, sure. but has not passed the legislature.
Senator Fredrickson and then Saxon.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson's question spurred a couple thoughts in my mind, and I'm curious about the number of bears we have in the state, the resource, so to speak, and the hunting pressure that's on that resource now and the bear population. I'm wondering if Mr. Bogus would come forward and offer us some information, number one, on the number of bears in the state, their desired number of bears in the state, and how many are taken by hunting and what effect hunting over bait has on that population, and if he has an idea of what allowing this new innovation would have on the
Mr. Bogus. Baking.
Mr. Chair and members, Ed Bogus again, DNR Fish and Wildlife Division. We do bear population survey on about a 5-year basis, and our last estimate was in the range of 25,000 to 30,000 bears in the state. Our current harvest level is around 3,000. I don't remember exactly, but in the 3,250, I'm told by the witness here. And it's been running in that 3,000 to 4,000 range for the last few years. The 1980s and 90s period, we were trying to limit the harvest of bears because it was very popular, and we had just established a lottery system for allocating bear licenses. But in the late 90s and the last few years, we actually had been trying to encourage some additional bear harvest to stabilize that population because the population had continued to grow during the previous 20 years or so. But now in the last few years, it's the bear population has stabilized in that 25,000 range. And so we think that the amount of harvest of bears that we're having through the hunting season right now is about the right amount to keep that population about where it is, and that's about as many bears as we need or humans can kind of tolerate. The population gets too high and we have a bust in natural foods, and we have all kinds of problems with nuisance and damage, bears in cabins, bears in campsites, everything else. So the bear population is doing fine right now with the level of harvest that we have.
What's the rules on baiting? Do you dump out the bait on one of those log piles or whatever, or do you leave the bucket out there?
Mr. Chairman, the rules are that, of course, you have to meet all the requirements that are listed in law here, and the witnesses are correct that we've interpreted this to mean that the bait can't be with any other material that's not biodegradable, because you get into containers and you start out with plastic bags, garbage bags, buckets, everything else. So we have told hunters that you can't leave any non-biodegradable material at the bait site. So it has to be biodegradable. The bait site has to be signed and with a sign in the vicinity, so that if it does contain illegal materials or it's not cleaned up or whatever, that there's a way our conservation officers can know whose bait that is and do some enforcement. Other than that, there's no limit on the number of baits or the quantity of bait that can be placed. And the reason that we allow baiting for bears and not for other species is because in Minnesota, the cover is so dense in the forest that it's really the only effective method that we've found for hunting bears here, other than possibly using hounds, which is not legal in Minnesota. So it's really not very effective to hunt bears like deer and just sit and wait for one to come by, because you very seldom would ever see one.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, it's from your response to the biodegradable materials, it seems that your reason for that is that you don't want a lot of refuse and junk left in the woods. This would not seem to fit. Somebody who spent $795 for a bear baiting buffet would not probably leave it there. So it would seem that is somewhat different than your motive here. Do you have a problem with this change?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, I know I wasn't involved in the meeting because I was off hunting something during early November when there was a meeting with the department and the testifiers here, and we don't believe, you're right, that it was our primary concern was leaving these non-biodegradable materials, and we don't think that's going to be a problem with something that you spend $800 for. So if a law is structured in such a way that it's only allowing this type of a device, it's probably not going to be left out in the woods. Our only other concern is just the kind of encroachment of technology into hunting, and this device does come with timers that allow you to basically at least have the ability to modify bear behavior on when they show up at a hunting site. So that's a different issue than the biodegradable materials. We do think this device is not going to contribute to littering in the woods.
Senator Olson, all of our baiters also are serial numbered, so if the CO would find one out in the woods, they would know, they could contact us, and they would know who the purchaser of that item was. And also, just wanted to let you know that he said they were, each bait station does have your name and address on there, and you also have to send in that name and address where you have your bait station located, has to be sent into the DNR offices, so you tells you where the county and the state or the, what land you're hunting it on, so the DNR can go in and check your bait stations just for that reason, correct?
So Mr. Chairman, Mr. Boggs, the one aspect of it that is kind of a bait management aspect that shuts it off at night, so you don't have other predators eating up all the bait that it's hard to lug into the bait site, would seem to be a positive. You're responding to the timing of when it's open as kind of conditioning the response of the bears. Do you feel that would have an impact on the numbers that would in fact be taken, or that would get that out of line if that were in place, or...
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, you know, we're not opposed to this idea. per se. We just think it's something that needs to be considered by the committee and the legislature as to where hunting bears is going. We don't, you know, given the amount of technology and the quality of the steel and so forth that's in this device, I doubt it's ever going to be a very cheap thing, and it's probably always going to be in a limited use. I certainly think that it could improve the efficiency of hunting if you had one of these, because a lot of times the bears come at night when the shooting hours are closed to eat the bait, and if they can only come during shooting hours, it's going to improve your odds of getting that bear. But I doubt there will be enough of these, given the cost and the difficulty of hauling them back and forth into the woods, that they'll ever have a real significant impact on the overall harvest. So we're not really concerned that they're going to lead to an overharvest of bears. And we control the overall bear harvest through a quota system. So if efficiency really does go up, we would issue fewer permits then.
Following up, Mr. Chair.
The other part of that, in terms of managing the numbers, but you know we've had some discussion. We've had people that were concerned about having cameras and really cutting that down. So you can remote triggers to weapons and so on. Do you believe that this is one that that the bears condition very quickly to that particular timing to truly make it an unfair hunt?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, right now bear hunters frequently do use cameras and trail timers to try to figure out when the bears are coming to the bait sites. This one goes one more step down that road by actually making the bait available. I mean, conceivably, you could have it be available, 10 minutes earlier every day until you've trained that bear to, instead of coming in at 9 o'clock at night, to come in at 7 o'clock at night or something like that. So this one does go one more step down that road, but there is already a lot of technology in hunting. And where you draw that line, I know Senator Paraso had a bill a year or two ago on internet hunting with the remote trigger. We don't allow that, but there is a lot of other technology that we do allow.
Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Mr. Bogus and what he's been talking about here, it has been tough to manage bears, I think, in the last period of years. We've had a stability with 25,000. Remember back in the old days when much of taking care of bears centered around dumps. We don't have any landfills anymore. But that controlled a lot of the movement of bears when we had landfills. That's, if you wanted to go see a bear, you'd go to a dump. And we I think have changed to two different ways of taking a bear, baiting, as we're talking about here. And Senator Anderson, I think it was the hound bill or the dog hunting bear with dogs that we decided we didn't want to do a number of years ago. So we've kind of eliminated that form of management. So we're down to one, and it does seem rather sophisticated, but I don't think it's like computers or doing it by remote control. And for that, I think I'd probably move Senate File 88 and recommend that it be passed on.
Senator Saxon, we're going to lay this over for consideration in the omnibus bill.
Say, can I move that, or are you just going to do that?
I'll just lay it over. Yeah. Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, I had one thought and then also a question. One thought I had is we're talking about this bear bait or buffet as being the only device on the market. Mm. I'm thinking that if we allow this, there will be others who manufacture something similar and make it available. That's true. Just a thought I had. But in paragraph B, clause 1, I'm curious why we would want to write this so restrictive as to say to restrict other scavenging animals and from taking bait at night. You know, why wouldn't we just say, I could see why you might want to say it cannot be a food the foodstuffs cannot be accessible all the time, but why don't we just say periodically restrict animals from taking the bait? You know, why do we care whether it's available at night or during the day? I was going to suggest to write it as designed to periodically restrict animals from taking the bait rather than being so prescriptive. Is there a response to that?
Senator Pariseau.
While I didn't draft this language, and I'm not certain who did, maybe Mr. Knopf would have some comments about how that could be, if it needs to be changed, or how it would be improved if we did need change.
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frederickson, Senator Pariseau, I did draft this originally, and if I remember correctly, this was a while ago, but if I remember correctly, this was the language I had suggested, I think, was just to do something similar to what Senator Frederickson wanted to do. And then a message got back to me, and I don't remember who from, but that they wanted to say they wanted the words at night in there and to restrict it from other scavenging animals. But I don't, you know, again, my recollection isn't precise on why those words were chosen exactly as they are.
Maybe in the meantime, we could talk to Senator Fischbach about what her thoughts are on that.
I believe wording. That we can probably answer some of that. Actually, when Senator Fischbach sent us this draft, we did make the suggestion that it would include the language at night. The basis for that is we certainly don't want somebody to come along, read this language, and say, okay, so I can leave a bucket during the day at my bait site and then just simply go back and get it so that scavenging animals can't get to it. We didn't want that. The baiter locks at night so that no animal can get to it. When a lot of your scavenging animals that do come to your regular baits that are just simply out in the open, when they do come, they usually come at night. So that's kind of a little bit more of a restriction as far as the language was concerned, so that we didn't run into the problem of just people suddenly deciding that they could put in buckets and pails and leave those items out there at their bait sites. We wanted this to be restricted enough so that they understand that it's locked, or at least there's some mechanism that prevents animals at nighttime specifically from getting to this bait. You can't have a device that certainly prevents your animals during the day from getting to the bait, because that's the whole point. You want the animal there during the day, but you don't want the animal there at night to get to this bait. So that's why we had thought that the restrictive language at night should be included in it.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Lucan, but I was thinking there might be folks who are into photography who might want to use something like this, and they want to take the pictures at night when animals show up to feed at night. And if we do that, I guess it'd have to be bare. I'd have to think through that. Maybe that would not restrict it.
And that could be, because actually this tool not only can be used for hunting purposes, but it's a great opportunity for research purposes as well. Being able to attract the bears to your spot at a specific time frame allows you the opportunity to observe these bears, as well as maybe even tag them for tracking devices and other purposes that the DNR or other research facilities might find useful.
Mr. Chair, we do have state biologists out of New York that are looking into purchasing these just for the purpose, she said, of tagging and registering bear during, so they can get them in during the day to do the tracking devices. And to answer Mr. Senator Frederickson's question on other devices coming out, we do have a patent on this. It's a patent pending, which we're looking forward to this being a permanent patent here this summer. The patent does fall under animal husbandry, which is a 20-year patent. That means nobody else could come along with another patent of such device for 20 years. And we are selling them out of state as of right now and into Canada.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious, does your patent cover devices? I'm not really familiar with how patents work, but for instance, could other manufacturers come and make much smaller models where it might not cost, $700 or $800, but could be more portable and shorter and cost a couple hundred dollars. My concern would be that, as the gentleman, sorry, Mr. Bogus, is it? Bogus said there isn't an issue with the, or it sounds like we're managing the bear population fairly well right now. And, while your particular invention here may not have a dramatic impact on the population of bear, perhaps similar devices, which may not be quite as effective but more prolific, could have a significant effect.
Mr. Senator, Mr. Chair,
Mr. Luckin.
Mr. Senator Steven, before I got into this, I did not know any of the patent rules and how it worked, but our patent lawyer that we hired definitely said that you cannot change any little thing of it. It's really tough to get a patent. I mean, our biggest competitor that we went up against a patent was against dairy cows, where they had a timer on the neck to go feed and eat when they disperse food. So that patent had run out, and that was 20 years. That was our biggest worry about getting the patent, was that. So it's really tough for somebody else to come in and, say, make a $200 item. They'd have to at least wait 20 years, or they pay us three times our market or our list price on it per each unit they make. And then you make them cease and desist through the patent office, actually goes after them that way. So in order for somebody else to come in and make one real quick, it would be pretty tough.
Mr. Chair?
I don't think you can patent an idea.
No.
And so I think that's where the issue is. And certainly they can't replicate what you've made, but they had something, the same idea. Like if it was a, we've all seen those electronic pet dish feeders. The slot moves around on a time basis, and if something like that were to be designed, and the fact that it has a time release is probably not patentable. So, I could foresee different looking devices that kind of accomplish the same idea being invented.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Vickerman. Senator Vickerman.
Mr. Chair, where's this go from here if it gets out of here?
We're going to lay this over for consideration in the omnibus bill.
I think you better, because when I sit and look around here, probably none of you hunted bear. I have. My sons do, and I'm just trying to figure out, if we're going to really make a major move here, I need to have some people that do guide to make a living up in northern Minnesota. I happen to know one up there. Are we putting him at disadvantage, or are we not? Because if you say a metal container, I could have 20, 30-gallon drums sitting out there in the woods. If that's their metal, maybe I'm not reading it right, but especially if we change it so get away from the scavengers at night. I remember being in this committee when a bow and arrow was crossbow. I have one. I used to hunt. Now my grandkids who hunt with arrows, bow and arrows, it's about 15 different little wheels, and any little kid can pull that. You took a good man to pull that 65-pound bow that I had. So I'm just afraid, are we getting this to such a... We're taking away the real, true hunting part of this, and that's what disturbs me the most. So I'm not going to support this, but we don't have to vote, David. I won't.
Further discussion? Any other comments, Mr. Luckin, Mrs. Luckin?
Just one comment, the fact that this device certainly is an aid to help with hunting, but in all honesty, bear hunting is going to depend upon your bear. And whether your bear chooses to come to your bait or chooses to use whatever natural resources available to feed upon is really going to affect whether or not you get a bear. Simply because you have this device, you're not guaranteed a bear, and we're certainly not making any kind of claim that this is going to guarantee that you get a bear, that this is going to, in any way, shape, or form, give you an advantage over somebody else who hunts in a different spot using the normal method of just simply dumping the bait on the ground and hoping that when you come there the next time and your bait's gone that it was hit by a bear. This will certainly let you know whether or not a bear is hitting your bait site or if something else is trying to hit your bait site. So I guess to some extent, yes, you do have a more of an advantage, but there's no guarantee with this hunting. You still have to be there when the bear appears. You still have to get the bear to come into your bait site, and you still need to get the bear to come into the bait site at the time when you're there. So there's still all of those factors remain the same. This device is simply allowing and opening up the opportunity for more hunters to enjoy this sport and to have success with it.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, I may have missed it, but how long has this been on the market, and is it allowed, and are you marketing it in other states that are having any experience that you could share?
Mr. Chair.
These issues?
Mr. Luckin.
Senator Olson. We came out on the market last spring, about April 1st, and we sold in, about 12 states now, and about six provinces. There's bear hunting in 29 states, black bear hunting in 29 states in the United States, and nine provinces in Canada. And this year we're really starting to have a lot more calls. We did testing on private ground in Minnesota. We did talk to the DNR commission about it, and that's where it wasn't really legal. That's where this came out. And we're building them in our state and selling them out states, and we really can't even technically use them in this state. But yes, we've had bear come in where we had them at night and did change them into a day bear. I hunted over them this year on private ground because we didn't get a definite answer: is it legal or is it not? It was a gray area. That's what the problem was. But I did not get a bear using them this year, but we did have bear coming in. I seen them, and I just didn't have the opportunity. I was archery hunting, and I did not have the opportunity to take the bear because it didn't come in fully. So you're still having hunting, and you still have the human error. I don't know if they had smelt me or what happened, but we did have a lot of bear coming in, but we just didn't harvest any out of our group.
We had one person in New York, was it? I believe that harvested a 300-pound bear using this device. So there is some success stories, but again, there's the other story saying, well, you know, we just didn't get the bait hit. So again, it's hunting. You're not guaranteed anything.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
We really appreciate your time. Senator Wergen, Senate File 283. And members, basically the non-money bills, policy bills are going to be generally laid over for consideration in the omnibus policy bill, and the bills that have a fiscal impact will forward on to finance if we approve of the policy.
Okay, Mr. Chair, and members.
Senator Wergen.
Mr. Chair, I think that means this bill would probably end up getting laid over. Mr. Chair, Senate File 283 is actually fairly simple. Our Constitution guarantees the right to hunt and fish in Minnesota, but as we all know, the land mass available for hunting has become less and less. Excuse me. So what this bill does is still completely leaves private control of private land, but at the same time it provides walk-in access on private land if those private landowners have chosen to make that access available through the DNR, essentially basically as a database. It also gives the DNR permission to contract with owners or lessees of land to establish a voluntary walk-in access for hunting. So you still maintain private control, but it's a new tool for the DNR to be able to offer more hunting land for hunters to disperse over. And this, Mr. Chair, is done in some other states already and has been fairly successful. And I know this past Saturday I held three town hall meetings in my district, and ironically one of the topics that came up in one of my more rural areas was specifically the overpopulation of deer on his farmland. And when I told him that I had this bill coming up today for a hearing, he was very interested in talking to the DNR about opening up his farm in this manner because the deer are consuming too much of his crop. And so I think there's some great potential for increasing the amount of land for hunting access and still maintaining private property and control of your land with no trespassing and things like that. That's the essence of the bill, Mr. Chair.
Senator Saxog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Wergen, will this have any type of fiscal impact? In other words, when we're talking about the contracts or the walk-in, are we going to be paying these people for letting us use their land?
Mr. Chair and Senator Saxhog, at this point I do not believe so. It's basically a contract for how it can be pursued, how many hunters are allowed, what the DNR will allow on the land with the hunter, kind of an agreement with the landowner and the DNR. But I do not understand at this point that there would be monetary value to the contract.
Senator Wergen, do you recall South Dakota, for example, what is the landowner paid to enter into this contract?
Mr. Chair, I have to confess I don't believe I have that piece of paper with me. I think Senator Pariseau brought it with her because the bill is identical, and she does have that. If we could have it handed out, that would be wonderful.
Yeah, I have one copy. That's it.
Senator
Pariseau,
do you...
We can get
some copies for that.
Yes. I do have another one, Mr. Chairman, that I just have. I hope that people can pass out.
Well, I didn't have, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
This is a model legislation from the National Association of Sport Caucuses. Okay.
I think I saw that.
That's based on the Kansas, I believe.
And I didn't see how I think I saw the general program.
Mr. Chair,
but I didn't see how much each individual was paid. But I could have missed it.
Well, Mr. Chair, I actually think you're correct. I think that addresses more the acreage that became available rather than any amount of money that was exchanged in a contract portion.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr.
Available.
Chairman and Senator Wergen. Outside of the issue of whether the landowners paid something to do this, is the issue here that the hunters would not have to obtain permission from the landowner, that DNR manages this and controls the numbers that are coming on the land? Or how does that work?
Senator Wergen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, that's basically correct, but the landowner would let the DNR know what his land is available for, basically how many hunters, that type of thing. So it wouldn't be just carte blanche, open it up. The contract would spell out what can be done on that land of that individual private landowner.
So
follow up.
Yes. So, Mr. Chairman, so DNR would manage the access then? I'd be interested in what DNR has to say about this as to how that works or what their role is in
the point.
In doing, other than just getting the agreement, do you just announce to the hunters that this is a piece of land that's available and anybody that wants to go on there at any time can, or how does that work?
Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, the way these programs typically work, there's different variations on them, but generally they're set up, a lot of times they're like an add-on to a CREP or some other type of an easement program where for an additional fee the landowner agrees to provide access. They're usually for small game hunting. Don't necessarily include other like big game deer hunting. And typically there would be a booklet or web or some combination of both North Dakota calls it a POTS program, South Dakota calls it a walk-in program, but where these lands are located, there are signs that are posted on the land saying this is a POTS acreage or this is a walk-in acreage, and then it's open to the public for hunting just as if it was, at least for that type of hunting, like small game hunting, just as if it was a wildlife management area or waterfowl production area open to public hunting. So.
Is there some sort of plat map then that gets published, and you can look at the plat map and
Mr.
see,
Chair,
see
yes.
which land is in that?
Mr.
Bogus.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I was just going to say a lot of times they will have a map that shows the locations and even the exact boundaries of the ownership of what's open.
So, Mr.
Follow up.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bogus, does that lead to any hunter conflict if you get an over attraction to a given parcel, or there is no management of how many you let on, or
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, it is something where land to hunt is there's a lot of competition for good land to hunt, and so it can lead to those areas receiving a lot of hunting pressure, just like a lot of our existing wildlife management areas do. But hunters are kind of used to this concept of dispersing themselves out, and it is likely that there would be a lot of demand for these areas, and hunters would have to kind of get there and see, is somebody already there? Then they have to go find another spot. But it would not be set up to where someone would be, you know, metering the hunting pressure on. The hunters would have to manage that themselves like they do on other public land right now.
To that point, Mr. Chairman, I have a copy here of the Kansas application, which would show that it tells everything. You can call the landowner about time of day when they can be reached, and I'd like to pass this around, but I do want it back. That's why I put my name on it. I only have one copy.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I first read this, I thought it was really just putting a plan together rather than actually implementing it, and so I'm a little unclear if this is actually saying go ahead and start doing this. DNR, start entering into contracts.
Okay, got the money.
Is that authorization here? And if that's the case, we need a fiscal note or something that's going to tell us how much it would cost to do it. I'm also, and so I'm not sure which one you're intending, Senator Worgen.
Well, Senator Worgen, did you want the DNR to put a plan together and then report back to the legislature for further implementation and funding, or were you just telling them to get going on this?
Well, Mr. Chair, actually, there's a little bit of a lack of clarity as to whether the DNR could just do this now under the current rule without a law. So we were just trying to make it clear that they could enter into these contracts. And I believe the intent is to allow the DNR to begin working on them as soon as they can, you might say.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
And Senator Anderson.
On the back, I guess I didn't see the last section, which says, before implementation, the commissioner must present the walk-in public access plan to the committees with a plan for our recommendations for implementation. So I guess I just want to be clear if that's what we would do if we pass this as written, that it would come back to us, and then we could discuss if there'd be any cost at that time. And, you know, it also, the discussion about CREP raises to me the, you know, a broader question. We've had a lot of discussion about this in the LCCMR about when we have programs like CREP and lots of other programs where we use state dollars for easements, what level of public access we're requiring under those easements. And, you know, I'm inclined to believe that when you use public dollars, you should have those rights to public access generally as part of what you're getting for your money. But I don't know if that's causes too many conflicts with, for example, in the CREP program, if farmers want to keep the land for whatever reason, keep it folks from hunting or walking on there for recreation. So it's just something I would like more information about, you know, is there ability to negotiate that access as part of a CREP contract or some of these other programs as part of the easement, and would it take extra money to do this or not?
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, no landowner has to enter into this program. I mean, they can just simply say no, they're not interested in being any part of it whatsoever. So it doesn't force a landowner into having anyone walking on his property for any reason he doesn't want to have.
Well, so, Mr. Chair, just to follow up. I understand it's totally voluntary, but Mr. Bogus raised the issue of, you know, if they're already in some kind of an easement program where they're getting CREP or whatever, where they're getting payments, then they already have some kind of agreement. And I was speaking to whether under those circumstances it makes sense to try to get public access as in exchange for those dollars.
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, someone else would have to answer because I do not know all of the intricate details of CREP land. For instance, Senator Frederickson could probably tell you that much quicker than I could.
Hey, Senator Pearsall.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that the DNR is already doing something on this issue before we direct them to do it, but they were planning to bring in a program to us anyway. And I don't know whether Mr. Bogus or Mr. Meyer or both of them or anybody else wants to speak to where they are and when they think they'll be ready.
Mr. Bogus, are you all thinking about this already?
Mr. Chair, we have been thinking about this, and I actually have a document that kind of summarizes what we've been thinking about, if the committee would like. Somebody could pass this out to the committee. But we also think this language in these bills before the committee would be useful because there isn't clear authorization for us to do this right now. And we think that there would be benefit in putting together a more well-thought-out plan. We think we could do that relatively quickly by early 2008 rather than waiting until 2009 or the end of 2008 as these bills anticipate. And I know we've talked to the both authors about maybe moving the date up, going ahead and doing a plan, but maybe moving the date up to January 15th of 2008. But just quickly to review, we're obviously aware of the walk-in type programs, access programs in other states, this is what the committee has in front of them. It's titled Draft 100 Walk-In Area Program for Minnesota. It's really just a summary of a little bit of history. This was the subject of a wildlife roundtable in 2001 where there was agreement after that roundtable that there should be more exploration of these types of programs, but that we shouldn't divert funding from existing programs to do it. It should have its own source of funding, whether that's an add-on to small game licenses or some other source of funding. And we have not pursued it real vigorously because our focus has been on our acquisition program and trying to get the land that we own and manage up to speed. But we have been talking to other states, and there's a Midwest working group of other state agency people. Our representative of that group wasn't able to be here today, but we are aware of the other programs. We know that they generally work well to the west of Minnesota. They generally don't work well to the east of Minnesota. Iowa has been having trouble with theirs. Illinois tried one and dropped it. Michigan's tried one, and they were kind of getting outbid by the private sector. So we think we're kind of on that transition line and where it may work well. It seems to work best in areas where you have large blocks of land, perhaps where you have more absentee ownership. We're hearing resistance from farmers in Minnesota who live on the land to opening up their land to the public. They just aren't real interested in doing that. But you get out to where we have more grassland in the western part of the state, and you have absentee landowners and others who see this as an added benefit. If they can get an additional payment to allow access, they'll do it. Just one point in talking about this with our commissioner's office that I wanted to be sure to make is that in addition to our acquisition program for our public hunting areas, we have been really advocating for access through the Forest Legacy Program, which is another type of access program for public land. We're running the risk of losing access to a lot of land in the forested part of the state that's been open, and we see Forest Legacy as a way of doing that or maintaining some of that public access. But we think there is a lot of opportunity with, particularly if we can tie it in with other easements like CREP or whatever. We wouldn't want to see it be a condition of a CREP easement because a lot of landowners then wouldn't sign up their land in those conservation easements if they had to provide public access. But if we could provide an extra incentive for access on top of that, we think that would be something that we should try and see how it would work in Minnesota. So this just summarizes kind of what we've been thinking and what's going on in some of the states around us. If the committee passes something similar to what's in either of these two bills, that would give us clear direction to flesh this out further, come back with some more specific recommendations, costs, things like that. We do think it would be somewhat of an experiment. We might want to pilot a program first because we're not really sure how much acreage is going to be available in Minnesota or what it's going to cost us. It's going to cost us more than in the Dakotas, and we don't have the extensive small grain and grassland that the Dakotas have, so it's probably going to be a higher payment per acre.
Do you know how much higher?
Mr. Chair, I don't really have a good feel for that right now. Our Bill Penning from our wildlife staff might if he was here, but unfortunately couldn't be here today.
Mr. Saxod.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bogus, this strikes me as being kind of similar to grant and aid trail easements in that in terms of, you know, liability and trespass. Also, would we be thinking in terms of limiting the time? In other words, would it be during just during hunting season that we would?
Mr. Chair, Senator Saxog, yes, it would be for a limited time and a limited purpose.
Well, Senator Wergen's bill talks about other recreational opportunities, including bird watching and outdoor activities. So under this, presumption would be that the access would be year-round, notwithstanding hunting and fishing seasons.
Mr. Chair, not necessarily. It still could be in the contract with that landowner that the land is only open certain times of the year, and that would be part of what would be basically on the Internet site or in the notice of that land, for instance.
In your first paragraph, you talk about access by the public for hunting and fishing, and then under on line 16, you're talking about bird watching and other related outdoor activities. What do you intend? You want everything to be at least considered, or are you just focusing on hunting and fishing?
Mr. Chair, I think the whole premise is the primary interest is hunting and fishing. The bird watching and other outdoor related activities are probably less intrusive, if you will, because there's obviously not the shooting or anything going on. But I think they could be considered as the DNR looks into the whole prospect, whether that would be something that would work with it, whether it would be too hard to basically administer the program with that broader parameter. So it would be something I think that the DNR would come back with their study as to whether that could work into it or not.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to offer an amendment to this.
Okay.
And the difficulty I'm having with this, it reads it partly as if it were law and partly as if we want them to plan. So I'm going to turn it into a plan with a report back from the commissioner. And that's my attempt. And to do that, I'm going to take this out of the statutes and make it session law. And on page 1, line 6, after outdoors, insert plan. And on line 7, after commissioner, insert of natural resources. Delete create and insert prepare a plan for. And then on page 1, line 8, delete plan. So I'd read, the Commissioner of Natural Resources shall prepare a plan for walk-in public access under which the commissioner may encourage no other changes. Then on page 2, line 1, delete before implementation, capitalize the. And on line 4, delete December 31st and insert January 15th.
I like the before implementation part. Doesn't that kind of clarify that?
Mr. Chairman, this turns it into a report to the legislature.
Yeah, it's not.
So it doesn't authorize them to implement it.
On January 1, 08?
And we're moving it up
January 15th.
A year, essentially a year ahead of time.
You said January 15th of 2008.
Of 8. Okay.
I believe that's what Mr. Bogus said.
Yeah.
They were prepared to
right.
do.
So you're moving that amendment?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
You got that, Mr. Knopf?
Yes. It's clear.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Fredrickson, I appreciate what you're doing here. It helps me understand. It makes it clearer, I think, what everyone is suggesting. But I see one other change, perhaps, on page 1.20, where it says develop. I think that needs to be changed because that sounds like
and
that should be a plan.
Recommend.
Recommend. Shall explore and recommend. Yeah, recommend sounds good. Delete, develop, and insert recommend.
I'll incorporate that.
Great, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rogan.
That's what I like about Senator Fredrickson. He catches all this stuff. I appreciate the improvements. I think it works well into the bill.
Amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Minutes adopted. Further discussion on Senate File 283. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bogus, in your earlier comments, you mentioned that you envision this more for small game than, say, for deer hunting and that type of thing.
Let's make it a tradition.
It appears that you also talked about, or it's come up that there's some advantages to the landowner for having this kind of entrance. Do you ever envision that there's a possibility of doing it without money, or is an incentive of a financial incentive required in order to achieve it?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, certainly could be done without a financial incentive. In fact, Senator Wergen's example, we do offer assistance to landowners that, for example, think they have too many deer and are, if they're having trouble finding deer hunters, we'll help line up deer hunters for them. So certainly we can help facilitate that. Our field staff know and often are contacted by people that are looking for places to hunt. We also work with organizations like the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, Pheasants Forever, and others that have members that would be more than happy to help someone out who's looking for hunters. So we certainly could do more, I think, through the voluntary aspects. The reason I don't envision this being a program for deer hunting is because that's fairly jealously guarded by most landowners. They have their deer hunting parties, and they're not looking to open their land to public deer hunting. But it could include that component if there was interest in it.
So Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bogus, this language allows you to explore different kinds of options that might, in fact, just be voluntary, or some reasons why some incentive might be necessary, and also to even though you said you don't see it applying to deer hunting, that might be a component of it as well. Or do you envision it just being for small game?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, I don't think we would rule out any of those possibilities at least in the planning stages. I suspect in our recommendations we will probably narrow it, but this is worded broadly enough that we can consider all those possibilities.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would hope that even if deer hunting doesn't end up a part of what we contract with a landowner for, I think one of the side benefits is that landowners, for instance, will know that something like this is available, and again, let the DNR know that perhaps they'd like some hunting this year on their land, and give the DNR the go-ahead to give a few hunters their name, that type of thing. I think that's a side benefit, because I think there are several landowners that probably wouldn't mind that at all for an occasional hunting.
Senator Fredrickson, I'm informed by council that Subdivision 2 is not necessary.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. I was considering, I think we should change it, but I was considering giving some comfort to those who are concerned about private property rights, and I would suggest that we delete this section is intended to, and insert the plan may, and delete other state laws including, and delete and insert or. So I'd read nothing in the plan may preempt trespass or liability laws. We don't need it, but it's comfort that you're not.
On the amendment, Senator Olson.
Would you repeat that, Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson. The new Subdivision 2 preemption would say, nothing in the plan may preempt trespass or liability laws.
Discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. Senator Parasol.
Mr. Chairman, I have to just say that in December when I went to that meeting and we had the presentations on both the Missouri and the Kansas plan, that they found them very, very successful, especially in and around large city areas, large metropolitan areas where people are don't seem they have feel they have much access. This kind of gave them access that is very successful in both states.
Mr. Bogus, why wasn't the program successful in both states you mentioned?
Mr. Chair, my understanding is generally as you get further east, you're dealing on average with smaller blocks of land, higher land prices with the moisture and soil conditions. It's more row crop or other types of cropland, higher population, higher human populations, more competition for land, and at least in Michigan, I know they would contract for land for their walk-in program, and it would get a lot of use, but within a year or two, their best walk-in lands were privately leased. They were outbid by private individuals looking for good places to hunt. So it seems so far that it works better where you have larger expanses of lower rental type land, maybe more absentee landowners, and less overall pressure for leasing land by the private sector.
Mr. Chairman, I would move Senate File 283 for passage, to in case it has to go to another committee.
This does not have to go to another committee. We're going to lay this over for consideration in the omnibus bill.
Mr. Chairman, I think that this one would warrant going directly to the floor, and that's what I would ask in my motion, if it doesn't have another committee path.
Well, Senator Pariseau, my intent is to lay this over for consideration in the omnibus bill. I think we do need to do this type of program. I think we're on track with this type of planning, and I support this.
And I sense that, Mr. Chairman, and I believe that since DNR is already working on developing a plan or a proposal, that it could be able to stand alone for that reason.
Okay. All right. What's the committee's pleasure? Do you want to vote on this? Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't have a problem with that going alone. I think there is merit to putting some, you know, related subjects in an omnibus bill. I don't have any problem with that. But given the circumstances of this, I could see that this could stand alone. So we'd have a few things to do on general orders.
Very few, but a few.
All right. Yeah, Senator Vickerman.
Is it your pleasure to keep this and roll it into a big bill?
Right.
Well, I respect my chairs, so I'm with you. That's going to kill it. You just want to keep it under control here.
Senator Olson, you going to comment?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if this one isn't an issue of control, I mean, are you seeing that you need it for bargaining bait or something, or what?
Baiting was a previous bill.
Huh?
Baiting was a previous bill.
Oh, yes. I don't have any problem with that one.
Mr. Chairman, I renew my motion.
Okay. Okay.
Dual tracking is done in several committees around here.
All right. Well, we'll take up Senator Pariseau's motion. Is there any more discussion?
So, Mr. Chair, are you suggesting that you're all right with this bill moving separately?
Well, my preference is for it to be included in the omnibus bill. But Senator Pariseau has a right to make her motion.
Okay. But if we want to support you as chair, we want to support the bill.
You could vote it down.
Vote it down. I support the bill.
We can vote it down, and we'll make sure it's included in the omnibus bill. That's the only other option that I can think of. Otherwise, we can vote it, and if you really want it to go to the floor, we can do that too.
Mr. Chair, a no vote does what?
It's not going to kill the bill.
Does it? What vote gets it into your control?
A no vote.
Okay.
Further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion does not prevail.
Let me see a show of hands, Mr. Chairman.
Division's been asked for.
Call for a show of hands.
Division's been asked for. All those in favor, please say aye. Excuse me, please raise your hand. Four in favor. All those opposed, raise your hand. On a motion does not prevail on a vote of 4-5. Senator Worgen, that does not bode badly for your bill.
Mr. Chair.
I think the committee likes the language.
Mr. Chair, I certainly take your word for that, and I appreciate hearing that. Thank you very much.
Senator Paraso, your bill is nearly identical to Senator Worgen's. Did you want to add anything?
No, Mr. Chairman, I do not.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Worgen.
Mr. Chair.
Next bill on the agenda is Senate File 150. Senator Paraso.
Mr. Chairman, we have one witness, Mr. Floor. Mr. Chairman, members, Senate File 150 is a bill that members who have been around the legislature for some time will recognize that several years ago, I'm not sure if it was 2 or 3 years ago, that we put in place the options for anglers and hunters to have lifetime licenses in addition to an annual license. And at the time we did that bill, the Trappers Organization did not necessarily come out full-heartedly with us because some of their people do not trap every year. And so they were a little hesitant. But they have passed resolutions in their organization now to help support it, and so we have a bill before us to include them in the lifetime, which is only an option and not a mandate. I would like to have Mr. Floor's comments because he's right up to date on everything in the organization, Minnesota Trappers Organization.
Mr. Welcome
Chair.
To the committee.
I've been a trapper for basically 40 years, and a lifetime license at that point would have been very, very desirable, and I think that still is the case. As our organization has spoken with each other, we find no problem with asking for a lifetime license. I don't believe that includes a small game license. I think this is standalone only for the trapper's license, and a small game license is still be needed.
Mr. Chairman and members, some of you will also remember, if you were around here before, that a year before this bill, the bill was allowed, drafted to put lifetime hunting and angling licenses in place, we did an actuary study. And the results of that were not only about usage, but about cost of all the different levels at which you might buy from birth on to senior citizenship. And so the figures you see before you in the bill are as a result of an actuarial study, which was applied to all the different options, angling and hunting different kinds, and now it's applied to trapping as well. So, Mr. Chairman, I would move the inclusion of this bill, Senate File 150, so that we can include the trappers in the option for lifetime licenses as well as all the other users of our natural resources.
Senator Paraso, this has a fiscal impact, so we're going to send this on to finance if the committee agrees on that. Do we know precisely what, or even vaguely, what the impact will be?
I don't have a fiscal note for it, Mr. Chairman. And frankly, the department might be able to give you a feeling as to how many licenses are currently being sold annually.
Bring up Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chair, members, we just got the fiscal note request, so we don't have a finished fiscal note. But 2006, there were 119 people who had lifetime either straight small game or lifetime sports licenses, which include small game. There were 119 of those people who purchased a trapping license.
And at $21 per trapping license, that amounted to $2,499 in 2006. In terms of the trapping licenses purchased by lifetime license holders.
Okay. So we're talking about something pretty minuscule. Senator Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, so this is adding trapping to the existing resident lifetime licenses. Would you envision that more people might buy lifetime licenses because of the trapping option? I mean, might this also have a consequence of countering that cost with more money coming in for life license?
I'm not sure if that question directed at me or at Mr. Boggess. I'm interested in answering it from the standpoint of assuring the future of trapping, which is, of course, of all the activities that are before us in the gathering field, trappers are certainly standing in line to be knocked off first. We all know that because there's been a concentrated effort against their activities for many years. And I think this will help to assure that because as we presented the lifetime license bill for hunting and angling, there were a lot of people who bought them for children at birth in order to make sure that their grandfathers, fathers, and uncles, and any friends, of course, could take them and assure that they would also have some interest in that throughout their life. And so I think that this could certainly bring that upward, too, on trapping.
Mr. Boggess, did you have any thoughts on economy of scale here? Are we going to – Senator Olson, from what I gather, I mean, there's $2,400 worth of – licenses, did you say,
Mr. Boggess? Mr. Chair, for current lifetime small game license holders, it's approximately $2,500. They bought approximately $2,500 worth of trapping licenses in 2006. Okay.
And let's just say all of those people bought a license, lifetime license.
These are holders of lifetime licenses.
Yeah. The reduction is... What, we're going to go from 2,400 to 1,200?
Mr. Chair, the total fiscal impact would be over the lifetime of the people holding the licenses, not just in the current year. So there would be some fiscal impact over the time that the person has the license, but on an annual basis, it's not a lot of money that we're talking about.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, I think you have to balance that with those who may buy a new lifetime license with this as an incentive to do that. And I don't know how we address that without getting an actuary to do a study, which would cost way more than the loss of revenue to the Game and Fish Fund.
Frankly, that's a discussion for the Finance Committee anyway.
Mr. Chairman, I think there's an ambiguity in this, possible ambiguity in this bill, because if this becomes law, we are going to have 119 folks who have already purchased a lifetime license before trapping was a part of it. And for those who purchase a license from when this bill becomes effective on out, there would be no question about what trapping would be included. So at the suggestion of Mr. Knopf, I think we should add an effective date section to this and make it effective when the lifetime licenses were first available so there would not be that ambiguity in those 119 who have already purchased a license would know that it includes trapping.
Okay.
Senator Parasol, did you hear that?
Yes, I'd accept that.
Mr. Chairman, I would move an effective date then. Mr. Knopf, do you have the details of
Mr.
that?
Mr. Knopf?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fredrickson, it would be a new Section 3 titled effective date, and it would read, Sections 1 and 2 are effective the day following final enactment and apply retroactively to licenses issued after February 28, 2001. I looked back at the original effective date of this of these lifetime licenses, and the resident ones were to be made available on March 1st, 2001, so that those would have been the first licenses that would have been issued in March of that year. That first potential license could have been issued in March of that year. I think this would cover it and would clarify that that these law changes apply to those licenses that have already been issued.
Thank you.
So, Senator Fredrickson, you're going to move that?
Move that.
March 1st, 2001. Senator Olson?
Not to that point.
On the amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted. Senator Saxog.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to comment on Senator Parisot's comment that trapping is one of the first things going to disappear. And I've long maintained that long before hunting and fishing and trapping disappear, there won't be anything to be doing. There won't be enough people to be hunting and fishing and trapping. So I see this as an incentive to get more people involved in trapping and people staying in trapping longer. So. Mm-hmm.
You're saying we will lose trapping by attrition?
Before we ever outlaw it, yeah.
Senator Olson.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, this I'm not intending this to be a financial question, but what has been, from the department standpoint, do you believe that the lifetime license has been a reasonably successful addition to our laws?
Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, yes, we do. Karen Beckman, who runs our licensing center, is here and may have more information on that. But we're seeing growing interest in lifetime licenses. We're doing more marketing. And at some point, we're going to need to take a step back and evaluate how the fees are charged. It's the actuarial question. Is it following the model that we thought it would back when Senator Parisot first authored the lifetime license provisions, and then how the money is being transferred into the Game and Fish Fund. Is that working the way that it's supposed to? But for now, we think it's been a very successful program.
So, I think the committee sounds like it's good on the policy of adding this,
yeah.
Senator Olson.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, so do you envision as over time, I know that we do put the amounts of these licenses in statute, if there is, I don't know if we've changed them at all since the lifetime license went in, but would there be some merit to linking, you know, if you increase license amounts a certain percentage, that you also adjust the life license, because that certainly does affect that value as well.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, that's a really good point. And it's one that we don't really have the answer to right now, and I think at some point we're probably going to work to do a study of how this system is working with this fee, because the only real concern we have about a lifetime license system is that it be properly priced so that, you know, we're not losing money or overcharging people. So until you run a program for a while, you really can't evaluate how well you're hitting that target. So, but you're right. If inflation all of a sudden went crazy and all of our other fees were going up and this one was staying static, that could be a problem. So the thought of indexing it to the annual licenses, I think, has merit.
Senator Parisot moves that Senate File 150, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Parisot. Senator Scogin.
Yeah, we're going.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Before you is Senate File 282, which talks about a reduced rate for senior citizens for an angling license. Just minutes ago, I was handed this is a has a companion over in the House that's been offered by Representative Bud Nornes out of my district, and it was a constituent request, and Representative Nornes just handed me a note that says that he is going to ask that age changes from 65 to 70, and that he's also going to seek some general revenue funds to make up for the loss to the fisheries budget. So I don't know how that changes what you want to do with this bill for me today, If you want to take a look at it the way I have it written and make amendments, if you want to lay it over for another day, if you want to, if you have recommendations, Mr. Chair, I would hear them.
I think it, we'll talk about the policy of giving seniors 65 or 70 the a discount on fishing licenses, whether we think that's a good thing or not, and let the Finance Committee determine if we can afford it or not.
Eric is hand.
So, Mr. Chairman, it seems to me that age 60, we're wanting people to work, keep busy beyond 65, so that I think there's some merit to upping that to 70. If they've got income coming in, they don't need to have a break. But that increase of age, I think, is probably an appropriate way to go. But that's just an aside.
Thank you, Senator Olson. And Mr. Chair, the fiscal note you saw was in regards to age 65. So if we're going to have a discussion about any other age breaks, that fiscal note, of course, would change. The bill that I was bringing forward, as I mentioned, was a constituent request just to change 65 and older from $17 to $8.50. I do not have anyone here today that is testifying on behalf of that. I do have a constituent who is here today who would like to speak against that. But in fairness to him, I will also ask him to come to the table.
Are you finished with your presentation?
Yes, it's pretty cut and dried. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Dave Thompson. I'm a resort owner in the Otter Tail area, and I have served on the Game and Fish Fund Committee for about 10 years, and last year I was the chairman. During my tenure on the committee, the committee, recommended that the senior discount be taken away about 5 or 6 years ago. We did a study at the time. I believe the University of Minnesota provided documentation from census data and that sort of thing that indicated that the 65-year-old and age group older had actually more spendable income than the younger age groups. And I'm probably on the young side of it, but as a baby boomer, we're all going to hit retirement age pretty soon, and the impact to the game and fish budget was going to be substantial. What I'd also like to point out is that on the fisheries side of DNR, the general fund allocations are very little. Last year, we got less than $500,000 in the fisheries budget for DNR that came out of general fund. So 97% of the fisheries budget comes from angler fishing licenses. So if you take $500,000 out of the budget, then you've effectively deleted all the general fund income to the DNR fisheries budget. The $8.50 discount amounts to about 70 cents a month to a senior citizen. And they're spending more than that on gas and bait to get to the lake. So we see no reason why seniors should get a discount.
Mr. Chair, I would add that leaving it at 850 does still allow us to qualify for federal funds. And also, I would hope that more seniors would buy the reduced price license and spend some money on bait, tackle, rods, reels, and gas to get out on the lake.
Okay. Senator Olson?
Mr. Chairman, is there, you know, this may complicate it, but is there any is there any way of making it income sensitive? I mean, the current license fees don't seem terribly prohibitive. At a current level, I suppose unless you are in a extremely low income, and there are people that have difficulty. But is there a way of dealing with that or not? If whoever might want to.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson,
DNR might be able to.
I think I had a brief conversation about that with the DNR, and at one time there was one that was on a kind of a sliding scale, very difficult to monitor, enforce, and follow up on.
Can Could I comment?
Mr. Thompson.
When the Oversight Committee looked at this, we found no more senior citizens that were unable to pay, or that were low income than any other age group. There are low income people throughout all age brackets, and so if you're going to offer a discount purely because of income, then it shouldn't be tied to age.
Did you study license purchases after the move back from the discount?
We haven't re-looked at it, but the new income to the that has come into the game and fish budget is there's no fat in it. It's funding things that we aren't getting money any other way for.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bogus might be able to follow up on Senator Olson's question.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Bogus,
Senator Olson, at one time there's been several variations on the senior license, but one of the variations was I think it was a $4 license, which was the minimum fee to qualify for the federal formula for reimbursement that's based on number of licensed anglers in a state. But there was also a provision where a person could basically claim hardship and get a rebate on that license, in which case we would have to issue a refund, and then there was no federal, we weren't eligible for the federal reimbursement, which was like $5 or $6 per licensed angler. So that was eliminated because it was just a very difficult system to administer.
Senator Bickerman.
Well, Mr. Chair, I could be on either side of this issue. but I want to tell you that my district in southwestern Minnesota, there are a lot of seniors that live on $200 a month Social Security, period. That's all they get. They just don't have any more money. And if license isn't bad, try paying $5 and some cents for 12 minnows, because that's what it costs you. It's a heck of a lot more to it than just that fishing license for whatever you want to do, we can do, but I can have a lot of fun with my kids because they got upset when I got my license for half price, and they said, Dad, you got all the money, and we don't have any. I'm trying to figure out what we do, and I did talk to the senator earlier on it. I'm not so sure it don't need a little study. I think we need to look. I don't know if we can take $500,000 out of our funds and be safe.
Well, we're looking at $730,000.
$730,000?
And that number will probably go up as our senior citizen population grows.
Mr. Chair, if I could comment on the budget, since I've been part of it, I don't have a copy of it for everyone because it has my notes on it. I was trying to get it for today. But it would show the general fund allocations to DNR in general, not just to fisheries, over the past 10 years. And 10 years ago, fisheries or DNR got over $55 million of general fund allocations and heritage enhancement. And last year we got $35 million. Out of that, the fisheries budget only got $500,000. 1 year we only got $25,000. So if you give this discount, it will have a substantial impact on the DNR fisheries budget.
Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, when we switched back a few years ago to charging senior citizens what we charge everybody else, I was on the side of and supporting the position that eventually prevailed. And by the way I looked at it, there's so many discounts that senior citizens get anyway. There's everywhere you look, there's a senior citizen discount. And it didn't seem unreasonable to me to ask senior citizens, where a lot of the wealth is already concentrated, to help pay for the boating accesses and the fishing piers and the fish restocking programs and all the things that DNR does to make this state a good fishing state. And to quibble about $8.50 here and thinking about the cost of sending it back if we were going to go that route to me doesn't seem appropriate. Plus, we need money. We got the $2 billion so-called surplus, but we need money to do all kinds of good things for this state. And I don't think a $700,000 tax cut or fee cut is appropriate. I think the senior citizens should pay their fair share of making this state a good fishing state.
So, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, are the senior citizens better at fishing? Do they get more of a take? And I presume, given the era that they've come from, they probably actually don't throw them back. They use them?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, I don't know that they're better, but they have more time to do it. And anyone who fishes, the more time you spend out there, the right. more successful you will be.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Thompson.
I don't have it, and I'm sure DNR has creel studies that would support or that would show age groups that are on the water both summer and winter, and I'm sure that they would be happy to provide that to the committee to show how many hours on the water seniors spend compared to lower age groups.
Okay, Senator Scogin, you want to make a motion? Go ahead and make your motion. We'll get to Senator Ingram.
Okay. Yeah, I'd like to move that Senate File 282 move to the Finance Committee.
Senator Scogin moves that Senate File 282 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Scogin, you mentioned something about federal dollars. Can you explain that a little bit better to me?
I believe Mr. Bogus. Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, I believe Mr. Bogus could better explain that federal fund that's available.
Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, the Game and Fish Fund is made up of license fees primarily, but also federal. It's actually reimbursements on a 3-to-1 basis that we get back through for fisheries. It's Dingell Johnson and Wallop Bro are the names of the federal congressional acts that collect and distribute that money. It's distributed back to the states based on a formula which involves number of licensed anglers in the state. For the wildlife side, it's Pittman-Robertson. I know it's area of the state. I'm not sure if it's area or area of water in the state. That's the other part of that formula. But there is a value in terms of what we get in federal reimbursement attached to the number to each licensed angler that we can document, and it's individuals, not numbers of licenses that they buy, and it has to be a license that is a legitimate license. Not just we can't just pass out licenses to people and then claim that federal reimbursement. So, and currently Minnesota is getting on the fisheries side through Dingell Johnson Wallop Bro about $10 or $11 million a year. In federal reimbursement, so it's a significant program, part of our program.
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, could we amend the motion to a no recommendation?
What's the process? Do we a motion be amended?
Send it forward without recommendation.
Yes, Senator Dibble, you can amend the motion.
All right. So would that be a substitute? Whatever the mechanism is, I would be more comfortable forwarding this to finance without recommendation.
Senator Dibble moves to amend Senator Scogin's motion to re-refer the Senate File 282 to the Senate Finance to the Committee on Finance without recommendation.
It's a separate vote. They have to vote on that actually.
And we have to vote on that amendment first. Discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. Now on the Scogin motion to recommend that Senate File 282 pass without recommendation to the Committee on Finance. Senator Scogin, if you don't like how your motion was amended, you can withdraw your motion.
Mr. Chair, I understand Senator Dibble.
If you're fine with it, then we can move forward.
I understand Senator Dibble's concern. I'm fine with it.
Discussion. Before we vote, I have an announcement that there is a separate folder in your folders regarding dedicated funding that we had saved. Staff now wants you to take that out of your folder
because it's going to be recycled at this point. So take it, take your dedicated funding stuff out of your folder if you want to keep it.
You're going to recycle the whole schmear of our save stuff?
No, not your save stuff. There's a separate folder that we automatically saved on dedicated funding. So if you've got stuff on dedicated funding that you want to save, either take it with you or write save on it. Otherwise, it's going to be recycled.
I have a save file here. Did you just leave that?
Yeah, just leave it there.
Is that the folder you're talking about?
Yes.
Put it in that save file if you want to keep it. Discussion on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.
Anything else for the good of the order?
Mine doesn't say save.
Motion prevails.
I suppose if I leave it in there, it'll stay safe.
Committee is adjourned. Yeah.